Thanks for being here. My name's Kevin Conover, and we're broadcasting down here in Southern California, where if you're watching the news, it looks like we are doomed. It looks like we're experiencing Noah's flood. And certain parts of San Diego County definitely are. So you can be in prayer for the people whose cars are now underwater and so forth. But overall, San Diego County is fine. So don't stress too much over it. But we're broadcasting down here on KPRZ 1210 AM and also on FM 106.1 in North County. And then, of course, all over the World Wide Web, as it was once known. And my guest this evening is Dr. Doug Petrovich. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He teaches ancient Near Eastern languages and biblical exegesis, ancient Near Eastern history, and he also teaches Egyptology, biblical textual criticism, lower, right, not higher textual criticism, at the Bible Seminary in Katy, Texas. And he recently came out with a new book called Nimrod, the Empire Builder, Architect of Shock and Awe. And this is really cool. If you know, if you, I'm sure you've heard the word Nimrod, usually in the past, at least, it was used in a derogatory sense. But this is a interesting biblical character that not a whole lot is known about, but Dr. Petrovich has done a tremendous amount of research in figuring out who this guy is in actual history. Dr. Petrovich, thanks for being on the program tonight.
My pleasure, Kevin. It's good to be with you and all of your listeners.
Yeah. Well, so, you've done so much amazing work, and the world you're in is so interesting, the amount of stuff. I know last time we had you on, we were talking about the book, The World's Oldest Alphabet, and that was super interesting. What caused you to decide to write a book on Nimrod?
Great question. Part of it, I suppose it goes back to my own initial interest, which was trying to figure out who is this guy Nimrod, because there's nobody in ancient Near Eastern sources that mentions a man of this stature in any of the literature, the inscriptions, anything. And so we're kind of left to wonder, well, who is this guy that Moses is referring to? And so when I was in my PhD program at the University of Toronto, I studied in a year-long course. I studied Mesopotamian archaeology, and that was a fantastic course. And in the midst of the course, I learned enough about Sargon of Akkad, who is the founder of an empire called the Akkadian Empire. It's the world's first empire. And the more I studied about him and learned about him, the more it caused me to ask the question, could this guy be the same person we read about in Genesis 10 that Moses calls Nimrod? And so I basically began to do an in-depth study of the Hebrew language of that passage in Genesis 10 and studied more about Nimrod. And I became completely convinced that this is our guy, that Sargon of Akkad is Nimrod. So through that study, I ended up writing an article, and I published in 2013 a journal article in a Christian journal called the Journal of Evangelical Theological Society. A peer-reviewed article on Nimrod connecting him to Sargon, and I wanted to see how that would go over with the academic world. And basically, from then until now, there really hasn't been any pushback. There hasn't been any scholarly attempt to refute what I wrote. And then, the time came that I wanted to make that article accessible to everyone. So I put it on my academia.edu webpage, which is kind of like for academics and for learners, even students. It's the real Facebook. This is where you go to find incredible sources on whatever area that's of interest to you. Whatever your field is, you will find scholarly literature in it, almost certainly, unless it's very obscure, on academia.edu. So I uploaded it there. And from then until now, Kevin, this article is the one that people have clicked on more than anything else I've uploaded. And I've uploaded a lot of documents. Published articles, teaching resources, interactive papers, book reviews, nothing comes close. And so that made me say, I bet this would be of greater popular interest. What if I were to take this article and write it, direct it more toward a non-specialist and produce a book out of it? And of course, with a journal article, you're limited in your word count. I had like 13,000 words. So I decided to write a book, and the book is now, well, ended at 70,000 words, and it really gave me a chance to expand things and talk about different things that are related to Nimrod, and even give an applicational section, in the final chapter. And so I'm very pleased with what's come out of it. But really, the heart of answering your question is, it's the fact that I saw such great interest, curiosity that people had in wanting to know who Nimrod is, that made me say, I really need to get this out for people who just love the Bible, especially.
Yeah, I mean it is so interesting because there's so many things that are a bit of a mystery in the Bible. One of the shows I did, I interviewed an expert on the word Nephilim in Hebrew, and that just took off, and people are very interested in these obscure people that the Bible passes over, but it's clear the Bible is emphasizing they made a big impact, even though it doesn't spend a lot of time on them. And just to go back to that, it's in Genesis chapter 10, 8 through 12. It says that he's a mighty hunter before the Lord. And there's not a whole bunch of other references in the Bible about this guy. Some people might look at this and go, boy, how in the world did you write 70,000 pages on this one small guy here? Were you concerned at all about that there's not a lot of text in the Bible? And then is he mentioned outside the Bible also, or is he not mentioned?
He's not mentioned outside the Bible per se. There is a site in ancient Assyria that's called Nimrud, but we really don't know 100% if we can connect that to biblical Nimrod. It certainly, oddly enough, happens to be one of the sites where he almost certainly had control and influence when he basically took his army to the north and invaded Assyria, and took these towns and these, villages, and turned them into urban centers for his purposes. So, that's some of what we have.
So, why is he called a mighty hunter before the Lord? What's the significance of that?
It's funny that you ask that question, Kevin, because this relates to something I talk about a lot in my book, which is, because I teach Hebrew, I teach all levels of biblical Hebrew. I have the tools to be able to really go into great depth and study the details, the minutiae. That's how I was taught. That's how I teach my students. And that's what I think helps us to illumine things in the Bible that are maybe not so clear, or maybe we have a wrong understanding of them. But the very question you have relates to something that I discussed in not a small amount of depth. And I think there's a better translation than he became a mighty one on the earth, and that he became a mighty hunter before the Lord. And it starts with the word that in English we have in most of our translations, mighty. That's not a wrong word for the translation, but here's the thing. In the Hebrew Bible, most of the time this word is used. It's used of people with positive connotations. David and his mighty men. These were men who helped David rid the ancient world in his day of evil people and accomplish God's tasks and take over the territory that would become a part of their kingdom. So I think it's a lot smarter for us to use a better word that doesn't have those connotations of positivity. So I think powerful is much better, because powerful emphasizes not the potential goodness that can come along with this person, but it really focuses on the characteristic that I think Moses is bringing out, that he had at his disposal an enormous amount of power. And that's true not only of Nimrod, but of Sargon of Akkad. So he was a powerful, and then most translations have the word hunter here, but that's not what, in fact, I would call this a bad translation. I understand why most English translations use this word. This word is also used of when Jacob and Esau. We have the Jacob and Esau story, and the word is used of how Esau was a hunter, right? And so because of that connection, coming to this word, this use, it was an easy thing, I think, for translators to want to try to suggest that he is a hunter, as if what Moses is getting at with Nimrod is he's, in his spare time, when he's not conquering cities, he's off having a good time on the hunt, tracking down lions or tigers or whatever. But that's not what this is getting at all. It's not about spare time. It's not about hunting game. It's very different. And the right word that's, well, the literal translation of the word that's used here is it's something eaten. So it could be grain, it could be, it becomes bread, it could be fruit, vegetables, travel rations, you name it. But that really doesn't make a whole lot of sense here. It's not as though Moses is saying Nimrod became a powerful foodstuff or type of food, right? That doesn't make any sense. But there's a use of this word in a cognate language, which is Ugaritic. And there it's used of a sacrifice. And when that word appears in a Punic construction, and the Punic people are actually Canaanites who left Canaan on boats and went to North Africa and established a stronghold there. And of course, later in time, they fought with Romans. But they had an expression that when you use this word with the word for a sacrifice, it becomes a sacrifice of slaughtering. So the idea is that it's a sacrifice of what? An animal. So you've slaughtered this animal in order to present it as a sacrifice. That's kind of the idea behind it. So going back to our expression here, Nimrod became a powerful slaughterer. That's what he was, a powerful slaughterer. What did he slaughter? Wasn't animals. Again, he wasn't on the hunt. That's not the point. He was slaughtering people. And if you look at the verses that follow, you can see what he does. He takes his singular kingdom, and he probably starts out at the site of Kish, and we know that from the biography of Sargon of Akkad. And then he expands it. He starts conquering other cities in southern Mesopotamia, and then he moves northward. And you find it in the text in Genesis 10. Verse 10 says, the starting point of his kingdom was, and I think a better translation here is Eridu. Then added onto that is Uruk and Akkad, and all of them were located in the land of Shumer. That's southern Mesopotamia, which is just north, northwest of the Persian Gulf. And then it says in verse 11, from that land he went out into Assyria, and he built up other cities, not necessarily built from scratch as if it's cities on, built on virgin soil, but he built up Nineveh and Rehoboth City and Kalhu and Rezin. So the whole point is, what is he doing? He's going out from his city with an army, which is implied there but not stated. He's clearly a king. And he's conquering city after city after city. And I'm convinced, Kevin, that the biography that we read in the Bible, it's like a snippet. These are hitting some high points. These aren't the only cities that he conquered. These are some of the more prominent cities that he conquered. So who is Nimrod? He's a vicious killer of people. He took his army and they wiped out city after city after city, and kept spreading their kingdom further and further and further. So what did he become? He became history's first empire builder, just like Sargon.
Wow, that's amazing. So help us help our listeners. What's the time frame here? Like, so Noah, lands in Ararat. The people are begin to disperse. And if I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is about 4,400 years ago that that happens. Where does Nimrod fit into that timeline?
Sure. And I'd say, Kevin, first of all, my date for the flood of Noah, I've got two options, but I'm convinced one or the other is right. One option would be 3298 BC. The other option would be 3168 BC. And it's very
Okay.
complicated, that the whole issue and how I arrive at that. I'd have to walk you through it. It would take me about an hour or maybe two
Yeah.
to walk you through it all. But those are the dates I have for the flood. And
Okay.
I have a rough date for the Tower of Babel events, the dispersion, that's about 2625 BC. Then my date for Nimrod's reign, he starts his reign in about 2320 BC, and he rules. We don't know 100% exactly to the year how many years he ruled, but the inscriptions mostly offer 54, 55, or 56 years. So let's say 55 years that he ruled. So that would take us to the end of his reign being in about, if the numbers are right that I'm calculating here, about 2265 BC. So 2320 BC to 22, 65 BC. So this is not quite 1,000 years. This is maybe 800 to 900 years after the flood. That's where the timing is there.
Okay, now I've heard people say that, he's the guy that built the Tower of Babel. Is that incorrect or is that accurate?
That is 100% incorrect. And I talk at
Okay.
great length about this, Kevin, in my book. In my introduction, I discuss a literary convention that Moses uses over and over and over. I cite three examples and I kind of draw out three examples. I could have cited more, but this literary convention I'm talking about is what Moses loves to do, and he does this right away from Genesis 1. He loves to make this timeline, and this is the big picture, right? I call it the flight at about, I don't know where your planes fly at, let's say 40,000 feet, right? It's a flight at 40,000 feet. And with that flight way over the land, you can see the whole lay of the land, right? So that's
Yeah.
what Moses is doing. And so he starts this timeline, he ends the timeline, it's all big picture. He includes little details here and there, but what he especially does is he limits those details, and he covers the bases that are maybe, well, he covers important things, but very vaguely. And then if there are any unimportant things, he includes them there and keeps them very brief. And then what he does is, and so let's say that's what we have in Genesis 1:1 through 2:4, 1:1 through 2:4. Really logically, and almost every scholar is going to agree with me on this one, the right way to divide the first two chapters of Genesis is not 1:1 to 1:31, but 1:1 to 2:4. Because there's what we have an inclusio there. It's like a sandwich, right? You have two pieces of bread, one on top and one on bottom. And so what starts Genesis 1:1 is repeated in 2:4. So it shows us this inclusivity of everything within that, hamburger or whatever you want to call it. And then in 2:5, he starts something new. And what is he starting? And some critics, Kevin, and I know this because going all the way back to my days, when I moved to Southern California in 83, I lived in Orange County, and I had a professor, my first course that I took, it was a Western Civ course, and he said, you can't really trust the Bible's story about creation because there are two different stories. There's one in chapter one and there's one in chapter two. And because they're different stories, they contradict one another. They don't fit together. So you can't trust it, right? And I, of course, well, I was a Christian at the time. I was exploding inside, but obviously I was just an undergrad student. What could I say to this professor, Dr. So-and-so?
Yeah.
I forget his name.
Yeah.
So,
And that's really popular. I mean, that's popular even today that people
oh,
say that.
for sure, for sure.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
I wish, Kevin, I understood then what I
Yeah.
understand now. Because here's the difference. This is Moses's literary convention. What he does in the second part, if you will, is he parachutes down from the 40,000 feet. And don't tell me, you can't jump from 40,000 feet. I don't take it too literally, okay? But he
Yeah.
parachutes down and he lands in the forest. And once he lands, he then gets out his science kit and his microscope, and he puts everything under the microscope, and he shows you details about something or some things that were part of the 40,000 foot view that he really needed to zoom in on, right?
Yeah.
So with that understanding, Kevin, that's how we approach 1:1 through 2:4 with 2:5 through the end of chapter 2. The first part is the order of creation. That's a chronological account. How do we know? Day one, second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day, and the seventh day you rest, right? It's purely chronological. That's exactly what I'm pushing at you, stressing to you. And then what does he do starting with 2:5? He parachutes down in. We have 6 days of creation, right? Which day does he parachute in on? Day six. Why? Because the most important thing in the entire 6 days of creation is what? Mankind. Mankind is the pinnacle of creation. So 1:1 to 2:4, the order of creation. 2:5 through the end of chapter two, the pinnacle of creation. So it's not two different creation accounts. It's one original account that hits the high points, and then the second part is zooming in on one area and blowing it up and showing you in great detail what you need to understand about that. So, that being true, Kevin, let's go back to Genesis 10. People wonder, could Nimrod have been around at the time of the Tower of Babel? And part of the question that's there is, or the attempt to answer it is, well, in Genesis 10, we get Nimrod. But in 11, we get the Tower of Babel. So it sounds like or seems to us that Nimrod comes first. But the thing is, what we're not realizing with just a quick reading of the text is that chapter 10 is one of those 40,000 foot views. And chapter 11 is a zoom in on one particular area. What we see in chapter 11, I think it's 1 through 11, the Babel account. That is an expansion of what Moses talks about in chapter 10 when he says that in the days of Peleg, the son of Eber, that the earth became divided. Oh, the earth became divided. What does that mean? It has nothing to do with the breaking up of Pangaea. Okay, I love the geology. I jump up and down about geology as much as anybody. That's not what's going on. It's the division of people because people are the crux of all of this. People were divided in Genesis 11. Along what lines? Number one, along familial lines, but number two, according to language. And that's what separates people groups from one another. God imposed that as a judgment because of mankind's attempt to exalt himself so that everyone can look at him and his great deeds, right? But now let me answer your question. With all of that background, we cannot suggest, we cannot accept that Nimrod lived at the Tower of Babel, time of the Tower of Babel. For me as a historian, right, my PhD is in ancient Near Eastern archaeology of the Holy Land. It's called Syro-Palestinian archaeology, but it's the Holy Land and the area to the north, Phoenicia and ancient Syria. With all of that, I just lost my train of thought, Kevin. Where was
Well,
I
you were
going?
talking about, well, we were going to a bunch of different places, but let's see, we'll get it back here.
Yeah, then
My
the real thing.
mind is going through a bunch
So,
of different questions I have
yeah,
too.
I got a little too far off track. And we can do a cut and splice here, but.
Okay, well.
Well, but this we have to get this because this is really important.
Well, we were talking about Peleg and that the people were split. Not
Oh,
so you got it?
okay. So, yeah.
Everybody
What
was.
we really have to understand here is that Nimrod was a king of a kingdom. And because of the fact that he captured other cities, it means other kingdoms were around at the time. And he became a conqueror of kingdoms, right? So
That
if
makes sense
that's
what you're saying.
true,
So, yeah.
then let's look at what's going on in Genesis 11. We have the first urban center in the ancient world after the flood. Forget about before the flood, but after the flood, it's the first true civilized city, if you will. What does that mean? It has things like architecture, monumental architecture. It has public works. Things such as irrigation channels, canalization and so forth. And it has a city wall, and it has an administrative governmental system, probably with a king at the top of it, and then officials and scribes and so forth. So all of these are qualities or characteristics of an urban center. And the Bible makes it very clear that the first urban center after the flood is Babel. That's it. So if that's true, Kevin, that has to be a time before you have kings, because kings only come when you have urbanization. So there weren't any urban centers at the time that Babel, wherever that is, and I'm suggesting it's Eridu, wherever it is, and however it was growing,
You're
there weren't
suggesting it's
urban centers
Eridu.
that could be captured, right?
Say that again. You're suggesting the Tower of Babel was at Eridu?
I'm suggesting the Tower of Babel was at Eridu, and I'll try to prove this in my fifth book on biblical history from the flood to Abraham. And
Okay.
Eridu is very close to the Persian Gulf. There are about 100 reasons why this is a perfect choice
What's in
for
Eridu
Babel.
right now? What's at Eridu right now?
It's just ruins.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you have time and money and the desire to dodge ISIS people, you may
Yeah.
be able to see it for yourself.
Yeah. I've got a bunch of different kind of questions going on in my mind here as I'm putting the pieces together here. Who would have been a biblical contemporary to Nimrod, meaning who is this is you said it's about 1,000 years after the flood. Is that what you said?
Yeah, but 900 or so, almost 900 years after the flood.
Is there a biblical contemporary during that time? How far after that is Abraham come onto the scene?
So, Abraham, his birth is in 2166 in Mesopotamia and Ur. So, Nimrod is, like a century and a half, roughly, let's say. He's a century and a half before Abraham. And Abraham, of course, is born at Ur. Ur becomes, it's like the second major ancient power, kind of, an empire, if you will, after the Akkadian Empire that Nimrod founds. So the Akkadian Empire is the first empire, and then there's a short lull, and then there's the what's called the third dynasty, not the first, not the second, not the fourth, but the third dynasty of Ur. So when Abram was born at Ur, he lived for a while at this site that had become, the great power of the day. It's like the Rome of Jesus's day, or the London of 300 or 400 years ago. It's the center of the world, if you will. It's like the
Yeah.
political, geopolitical center. So that's where Nimrod fits in with Abraham. But to answer your question, we really don't have any mentions of contemporaries of Nimrod. And in the account itself, it's interesting how it's actually worded, because Nimrod is not said to be the son or the grandson of Cush, who is, of course, a descendant of Noah through Ham. But the terminology that's used makes it vague. It just means he's a descendant, however far down you have to go. So really, in the days of Cush, he's around, 3200 BC. Well, Nimrod doesn't show up until 900 years later. So if I'm right that Nimrod is Sargon, then it makes perfect sense that Moses didn't try to give a straight genealogy from Cush all the way down to Nimrod. He just vaguely refers to him as a later person in that line.
Now, how much historical and archaeological evidence do we have for the person of Sargon?
Well, obviously, a lot more than for Nimrod. So, what I know about Nimrod, most of it comes from Sargon. But they have this amazing parallel biography, and that's what makes it so cut and dry. They're the first two major conquerors of Assyria, and they're both the first two who seem to, bring it to a crescendo, bring it to a place of prominence. So, we have that going on too.
Where do we draw the evidence for Sargon? Like what ancient documents reference Sargon?
So we have several stela, which are mostly stone carved inscriptions that have drawings on them, and so there's writing on those. We have a lot of, and this is really important in all of this, Kevin, to understand how extensive his kingdom was. Oh, I guess I forgot inscriptions. There are lots of small, short, Turk inscriptions that mention him and talk about cities that he conquered and so forth. But we have a very clear sense of the type of material culture that was around in the beginning of the Akkadian Empire, which means we know what kind of bowls and cups and saucers and jugs and whatever and tools and weapons and so forth that they used. And when we go to other sites, either close by or far away, and we find a huge slew of the same exact types of things, that's like red flags telling us, uh-oh, it sounds like this is one of the places that was conquered by the Akkadians. So we have archaeological evidence that goes all the way up into northern Mesopotamia and even north of the Tigris River into northern Assyria there. And there are sites that clearly show all of these telltale signs of the Akkadian Empire.
So for those of you listening, maybe you're just tuning in, Dr. Doug Petrovich is my guest today, and he is an expert on ancient Near Eastern languages, biblical exegesis, these sorts of things. And you can check out all his stuff at youtube.com/ Illumining the Path. If you're interested in his book, Nimrod the Empire Builder, you can check that out at Petrovich Doug on X, formerly Twitter. To buy the book. If you want to do that, that's at Petrovich Doug. And Dr. Petrovich, another question I had is, in what I read a little bit about this, and some people said that they think Nimrod could have been Gilgamesh. What are your thoughts on that?
Interesting. There are numerous negatives to that possibility, drawbacks to it. Number one, from all of the sources, the ancient sources that have survived, and there aren't that many with Gilgamesh, scholars aren't even convinced that he's a historical figure. That's number one. Many scholars are convinced that he was a mythical figure that was kind of dreamed up as this ideal, powerful leader, king. And so we can't be even 100% sure about that. But secondly, he was the king of Uruk, and that's one of the cities that Nimrod conquers, but that's not where he starts. And Gilgamesh is one of the early rulers of Uruk. It's early in the dynastic period, maybe even in the Djemdet-Nasser period. And where that fits in Mesopotamian archaeology is it's before we have empire builders, right? So even if we could get around the other problems, we're left with this really big problem that he's way too early before someone is conquering someone from Shumer or southern Mesopotamia. It's the Bible's Shinar, which is a transliteration from Hebrew right into English, but it's Shumer, the area of Shumer. He goes. So the thing with Gilgamesh is he is king at Uruk, but it doesn't really say in the few documents we have of many cities that he conquers, and certainly he doesn't go into Assyria far to the north and conquer city after city and set up or erect this empire. So he has to be considered a figure that, I mean, it's definitely one option to throw out there, but the negatives by far exceed the positives.
And are there really too many options as far as who this person could be? I mean, from a looking at ancient history and people who were, that prominent, Are there other alternatives that you kind of went through the list and just through the process of elimination said no? Or is Sargon pretty much the only possibility?
Well, certainly there have been other options that were put out there. I actually discuss in detail Gilgamesh, so you can read about that in my second chapter. And Kevin, I call my second chapter fun. I call it "Pin the Tail on the Donkey," and the reason I do that is because it's as if scholars are putting a blindfold on, being spun around, and they, plop the thumbtack of the tail somewhere against some scholar, against some ancient figure. And so Gilgamesh is one of those. I also talk about Ninurta, who's of all things, he's the god of war. Well, how can you say that the god of war is Nimrod when clearly the Bible is very forthright about the fact that Nimrod derived from one of the sons of Noah. And these are all physical human beings who derive from Adam, right? So there's a purely human element that has to be true of whoever Nimrod is, if you're going to take all of these details of the Bible seriously. So I discussed Nimrod. I discussed the three main scholarly choices, Kevin: Ninurta, the god of war; Gilgamesh, this king of Uruk. And the third one is there's an Egyptologist who suggested, of all things, that Amenhotep III, a pharaoh of Egypt from the 14th century BC, that he is Nimrod. And obviously that can't be right because Moses dies in 1406 BC. Amenhotep III takes the throne in 1407 BC, the year before Moses dies. So there's no way all of this activity can take place and then Moses can write about it. Within a year's span of time. So these options that scholars have put forth are just impossible.
I just have a couple other questions here. I'm kind of bouncing around. I hope you're okay with that. But one of the interesting things in the Bible, of course, is how long people live after before the flood and after the flood, and then the lifespans drop off. And as looking at Job, it looks like he lived maybe into the 400s or something like that. Are people still living a long time at this point in history, or have the ages dropped off? One of the reason I asked the question is because some of my students were bringing this up, and they were saying, they're asking like, what are the Nephilim and all these different questions. And one of the things that I've heard is people say that, well, if a person was able to live a long amount of time, they would have been able to accumulate a lot of wealth. And if you've got some guy who's dominant, he could eventually dominate through, like you're saying, basically empire building, accumulating wealth. And because he was able to live a long time, that would have been even a greater amount of wealth and power. Is there any truth to that, or is this farther down the line?
So, in other words, in the lifetime of Nimrod, is it possible that you could have rulers who were building empires who lived exceedingly long lives? Is that the question based
Yes,
on?
that's the question, yeah.
Okay. So, it's not impossible, certainly at this point in history, in 2300 something, so the 24th century BC, we still have lifespans that are longer than what we see in Moses's day and after that, right? Because Moses lives to 120 years, the Bible only refers to one human being living longer than 120 years after Moses dies. And you'll find that in Chronicles. It's a guy who lives, it's some obscure figure, I even forget his name, but he lives 130 years. So that's an anomaly, right? That's a one-time deal. Apart from that, like you're saying, lifespans of people from the flood all the way down to Moses, they go down. Now, it's not a straight slope, right? It's not like a ski slope that's 45 degrees or whatever. It's more like an EKG that's, it's got these ups and downs, right? But it's got this constant downward trend, and that's what's going on. So, yeah, remember, Nimrod lives 150 years or so before Abram, and Abram lives to what, 175 years? I forget exactly. I think that may be
Yeah,
wrong.
I think you're right.
About 175 years or so for him. So certainly it's conceivable that he would live longer than that. And his reign, Kevin, is 50. Remember, let's go back 55 years or so. 55 years. That's a
Yeah, it's a
long
long time.
reign. Yeah.
That
I
is.
mean, outside of, our recent Queen Elizabeth, no, not who just died? Wasn't it Queen Elizabeth
Yeah,
the
Queen
second?
Elizabeth. Yeah.
Yeah, she had a long reign. I
Yep.
don't remember how many years it was, but it's exceptional for a monarch to rule that long. So yeah, the possibility was there for that kind of lifespan. But remember, God put down the clamps at the time of the flood. He did a lot of judging. And one of those things that he did, and this is in reference to your question too, he established a boundary. He said that mankind's lifespan was going to be 120 years. Why did he do that? He was sick and tired, if you will, of people living hundreds and hundreds of years, and they're not getting better. They're not getting holier. They're not getting more, deferential to others. They're becoming more selfish, more wicked, more evil. And I don't know about you, but I notice that in our world. The older people
Yeah.
get, the crankier and the ruder and the uglier inside that they get. On the whole, not everybody, but on the whole. And hopefully with believers, it's very different. But many times we're just like the world. But the whole point is, God wanted to see less life for these wicked people who aren't getting better. So that's why he instilled this judgment. Now, you can wag your finger and say, well, Dr. P, and that's what my students call me, and because it's too hard to say Petrovich, they'll say, Dr. P, why didn't, if this was God's pronouncement, this was his judgment, why didn't it happen right away that they were living 120 years? Well, okay, number one, what about the character of God? With God, a day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as a day. God
He's
is,
long suffering.
he's long suffering. He has loving kindness. He has mercy. Look at what he does with the Israelites and the Judites. He goes on and on and on with his patience,
Yeah,
and he
and
waits and
he gives
waits.
chances after chances after
Yeah,
chances.
right. More opportunities to repent. And still God is waiting patiently. So, but the whole point is, yeah, all of that patience and long suffering is true. But the other side of the coin is that God's laying down the law that he's saying it's going to be 120 years. But the point is, God decided to be patient and wait to fully install that actual fleshing out of the 120 years part. So yes, it's possible people could have ruled longer, but the bottom line is, Kevin, I mean, yeah, well, there's a lot less ink on it in Genesis by Moses. So I can't be conclusive here, but I would suggest to you, from what we know about later stories in the Bible about kings and empires and whatnot, God doesn't wait too long before, he uses an empire, he raises up an empire to judge another empire that was before them. And so that earlier empire, when God has had enough of their wickedness, they're gone. And that's it. The new empire comes in, takes them out. And then some years later or decades later, what happens? That empire has its judgment day, and they, lose all of their power in their kingdom and so forth, and somebody else takes over. So God doesn't usually let it hang on that long. That's the point.
Well, we're coming up on our time here, but I had one more question, and this has to do with a series that recently came out. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not. It's called, it came out on Netflix. It's called Ancient Apocalypse. Have you heard about this?
No, have not.
Okay, so I just wanted to throw this your way because you're an expert on these things, and this is becoming popularized. It's got really high ratings. It's 90% like this TV show. It's hosted by a guy named Graham Hancock, who says he's not a professional archaeologist, he's just a journalist, but I guess he's been doing this for a really long time. And he said that he basically is going through all the stories of a flood in all the cultures around the world, and he's visiting these places. But one of the things he stumbles on, and the series really focuses on, is the existence of pyramid-like structures throughout the world. So he really spends a lot of time on this. He goes down into southern Mexico, I guess it's one of the biggest pyramids in the world is down there. He actually says the base of it is bigger than the pyramid in Egypt. And then he references those and all these, and then he starts to go back into the stories that are in the cultures, and he emphasizes this heroic figure that seems to be a Noah-like figure, and just a bunch of different things. It's pretty interesting. He's way off base from the Bible in a lot of the things he says, but it's almost like a secularist coming in and trying to make sense of all this stuff. And one of the things that struck me, which I was just curious to hear your thoughts on this, was I read about the Toltec legend. I don't know if you've heard about this. The Toltec legend actually says that part of the reason the Tower of Babel was built was to escape the possibility of another flood. And I was just curious, and I know this is a little bit off topic, but I was curious to know your thoughts on, do you think that that actually correlates, that there is these pyramid-like structures around the world because people had in their mind that this flood had happened and now we want to prevent this from happening? So as they went and dispersed around the world, they began to build these structures with that memory. Do you think there's any truth to that story, or is he just way off base?
Good
I know
question.
I'm kind of coming out of the blue for you with this, but
Yeah. And I would say first I want to tackle the heart of the question at the end that you had. I don't think there's any desire on the part of these people to build these structures to try to escape another flood. Listen, it's very cut and dry. The instruction that God gave, and there was even a covenant that was part of this, and a rainbow that was given to signify that he gave his promise that there would not be another destruction of the earth by water.
yeah.
But let me try to quickly make sense of all of that for you. And this is kind of a teaser for my fifth book, which is not going to come out anytime really soon as I'm speaking in 2024, but hopefully in coming years it will be fully written and edited and published. But I was in a documentary called Is Genesis History? Came out in 2017, and you mentioned Netflix. In the summer of 2017, it was the number one documentary in all of Netflix.
Wow.
Atheistic or Christian or any, you name it, the number one. And all these different scholars were addressing issues related to the early part of Genesis, saying, is the history we read about in the Bible, can we find ways in life through science, the study of science, that's going to help us corroborate? And so I was invited to address the topic of the Tower of Babel. Why? Because in my study, in my PhD program, in that year-long course I took on Mesopotamian archaeology, another groundbreaking discovery that I stumbled into was the right site for the Tower of Babel, the right building for the tower, and the right outward expansion of people that I refer to as the post-Babel dispersion, right? So if Eridu is the right site for the Babel of Genesis 11, it's again an amazing option for so many reasons. One of which is this was, Kevin, the first city, true urban center in the entire world that we know of. And most scholars are convinced that it's that very thing, the first urban center, Eridu. And at Eridu, they had 18 phases of a temple that was built. So in other words, it started really small, and then when they realized, oh, we're expanding, let's make it bigger and better. Okay, so option, temple two, and then temple three. And it goes all the way to temple 18. That's how much the city was growing, and the need to expand the temple was growing. And in the last two phases, Kevin, of the temple's use, and by the way, it's all of a sudden stopped being used at the end or during the 18th phase of the temple, or the 18th version of the temple. But for the last two phases, adjacent this temple, and the temple, by the way, was massive in size. Adjacent to it was a platform that was so big it actually dwarfed this massive temple. And on top of that platform, there was a structure built That was the first, what we call, it's a German word, but we call a ziggurat.
Yes, yeah.
And that ziggurat, the archaeologists who dug there discovered that it was, they excavated at the foundational level and found that it was built, the platform was built during the late Uruk period. Well, the late Uruk period, Kevin, is the period of what historians know of as the Uruk expansion. And in my book, I'll be trying to prove that the post-Babel dispersion is the very same thing as history's Uruk expansion. It's an outward movement of people from Mesopotamia, not tradesmen, not delivering products, but people physically moving to other places, right? So, what they also found about that structure that's opposite the temple is that it never was completed in the building of it. It wasn't completed. It was abandoned. But later in history, when in the third dynasty of Ur, which is the lifetime of Abraham, in the third dynasty of Ur, the neighboring city of Ur, that's a neighbor of Eridu, it was the center of the world, right? Well, this close by city of Eridu had this ugly eyesore, right? And Ur must have been extravagant, beautiful, top of the line, everything, gorgeous, immaculate city with all of these original innovations. But Ur so close looking, but Eridu so close but looking dilapidated, they decided. So the king appointed people to go over to Eridu and complete the building of the ziggurat. And there are bricks from that very king that have survived and in again an eroded state since then. But that very tower is the Tower of Babel. And
Wow.
that model of the Tower of Babel was dispersed at the time of the late Uruk expansion, the post-Babel dispersion, along with all of the people. And so, Kevin, when the people leave the city, what do they take with them? Well, not so much, there's only so much they could carry, but everything they saw, everything that was engineered, everything they knew, they could take with them, couldn't they? So they
Yeah.
took the blueprint for the idea of a ziggurat, and wherever they went, they built, well, many peoples built a similar structure. We see it all over much of the world, minus
Yeah.
Antarctica. So I'm convinced that this is because of what took place at Babel. That's why we get this mass amount all over the world. And of course, as all of these events are taking place, of course, what began as Pangaea at the time of the flood and soon after, wherever that fits in exactly, broke apart and expanded into the modern continents. And so you have people leaving with land bridges or by boats or whatever, and entering on what become other continents that now have, or that much later have drifted much further apart. So the fact that we have these kinds of structures all over makes perfect sense to me. It starts at the Tower of Babel debacle.
Yeah, that is just incredible. Well, this is amazing stuff. For those of you who maybe you're just catching the end of the tail end of our show here, my guest is Dr. Douglas Petrovich, and we've been discussing his new book, Nimrod, the Empire Builder. And Nimrod is this prominent figure in the Bible who's brought up quickly, but he kind of disappears. But he's a significant figure historically. And if you're interested in this sort of thing, which I find just absolutely fascinating, you can check this out on Dr. Petrovich's Twitter handle at Petrovich Doug on X. You can buy the book there, and you can also follow him on YouTube, Illumining the Path, youtube.com/illuminingthepath. And Dr. Petrovich, you said you're going to be putting a lot of stuff up there. Is that correct?
Yes, in the coming days.
Fantastic. Okay, well, thank you so much for being on the program. I really appreciate it. This is just a big blessing. So thank you.
My pleasure, Kevin.
Absolutely. And my website's educateforlife.org. We got all kinds of resources up there, as well as hundreds of interviews. And we're going to be having more information about this historical period. We're going to be talking a little bit about the flood next week with Dr. Ron Neller. from Creation Ministries International, discussing what convinced him that the biblical flood was a historic event, what changed his mind. And then we've got some really interesting stuff about the Ice Age coming up with Dr. Tim Clary of ICR, and a variety of other shows on the horizon that I think you'll find very interesting. So thanks for being with us this evening, and I look forward to seeing you next time. I hope you have a fantastic week, and that you continue to pursue God through all the different ups and downs that we're dealing with around the world right now. And just keep praying that God would continue to lead people to Him. God bless you and have a great night.